Blog Talk Radio.
This is Get Deep and Keep It Real with Tiffany Camilla. Make sure you check us out on blogtalkradio.com, Get Deep and Keep It Real. You can also find us on Facebook, Get Deep and Keep It Real, and of course on Twitter. If you have any questions, you're more than welcome to hit us up on our Facebook account and on our Twitter account. So any comments or questions or any special requests for guests or show topics, please always feel free to hit us up on Facebook or Twitter. And if you would like to call into the show, please do. Our number is 347-215-9738. That's 347-215-9738. You're listening to Get Deep and Keep It Real with Tiffany Camilla.
Thank you so much for joining Get Deep and Keep It Real today. I know I'm on at a different time today. Yes, you're getting extra special attention from me this week. I was on yesterday, I'm on today, and I'll be on tomorrow. So make sure you check me out tomorrow, where I will be speaking with Pashawn Wilson. I'm sorry about that. Pashawn Wilson, and she's a young lady who's done a documentary on fibroids. So make sure you check us out at 5 p.m. usual time for a very inspiring inspiration with that young woman and her journey going through fibroids. Today, I have a very special guest, a very wonderful, spirited, educated woman, advocate for infertility, Miss Miriam Zoll, and she's also an author. She's written a book called Cracked Open, so make sure you check that book out. And without further ado, I would like to welcome her to Get Deep and Keep It Real with Tiffany Camilla. Hello, Ms. Zoll.
Hi.
How are you?
Hi, Tiffany. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thank you. I am so happy that we were able to connect and that I could have you on the show today because I really wanted to have a conversation about infertility and kind of the process and all this that women are experiencing, men and women, couples, are experiencing with infertility, but not many of us really know about.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on. As you mentioned, I'm the author of the book Cracked Open, Liberty, Fertility, and the Pursuit of High-Tech Babies. That was published last year, and the subtitle, I think, says a lot about people's experiences with the challenges of trying to have children. The liberty in my title focuses on the liberty that women in the United States in particular have enjoyed since the 1960s and 70s when the women's movement opened up so many opportunities for us. And the liberty, fertility is focusing on the choices that women and men are making about whether or not they want to become parents. There's a lot of individuals who are choosing not to have children at all. There are many mm-hmm. women who are delaying motherhood for many different reasons. And the pursuit of high-tech babies has to do with the kind of mental health issues that women and men who are facing challenges becoming pregnant often face. And it also mm-hmm. has a double meaning. The pursuit of high-tech babies also speaks to the infertility industry, which is 36 years old. It started in Britain in 1978 when the first IVF baby was born. And it is turned into a multi-billion dollar business that is not just focused on IVF. It's also focused on third-party reproduction in terms of the recruitment of young women to donate human eggs to older women in particular who are having trouble conceiving, and also the commodification of women's reproductive capacities through commercial surrogacy, particularly in poor countries like India, Thailand, and Mexico. Mm-hmm. You do also have a number of people coming to the United States from countries that have made commercial surrogacy illegal. So you do have mm-hmm. a commercial surrogacy industry in the United States, but many people are going to poorer countries where young women who are living in poverty are agreeing to carry the child of a wealthy couple from another country.
Wow. Very deep. That people would really go to that extent to try to have a child. Wow.
I think that the desire to have a child, particularly if you have some type of health condition or unexplained fertility problem, is very strong. And for women who delay childbearing until the onset of menopause, which begins around 37 and a half years of age and begins to intensify through women's late 30s and into their 40s, it becomes a real panic button and a real panic situation. And there are many, many couples who I have met, particularly since my book was published, who have shared their stories with me. And I also am a former consumer of these reproductive technologies. I had what the industry called age-related infertility, which before the rise of reproductive technologies was called the onset of menopause. So you're looking at nature versus technology here, and you're also looking at the lack of reproductive health information being distributed and presented to women and men, not only in the United States, but globally. There's a lot of misinformation about our natural reproductive lifespan.
Right, exactly. And I wish you could, is there any way you can maybe expand on that? What we're missing, what kind of questions we should really be asking at what age?
Well, I think particularly in the United States, the polarity between the debate about sex education has been so controlled by tell kids about condoms and the pill or don't tell kids about the condom and the pill. And it's become a reproductive health rights war with almost a parental rights or religious control discussion. The fact of the matter is that the focus on whether or not to tell children that if they become sexually active, there are things they can do to prevent pregnancy, the focus on that has, in fact, now backfired into both camps, because now you have a whole generation of young women and men who believe that women's fertility does not decline until age 40 or 45, when in fact it's beginning to decline a bit at 35. So the old discussion of at age 35, you need to really know what you want to do about becoming a parent or not, that fell off the table about 12 years ago, 14 years ago, and it was replaced with a discussion of, well, you know, women are fertile longer, and I don't need to worry, and if I have problems, I'll just have an IVF cycle and I'll get pregnant. But the fact of the matter is, IVF has extremely high failure rates per cycle. It's 80% global failure rate per cycle, according to the European Society for Human Reproduction and Embryology. And in the United States, there's a 71% failure rate across all age groups nationally, according to the Centers for Disease Control. So I think there's a lot of misperceptions about our natural reproductive lifespan. There's a lot of misperceptions about the miracles of what IVF could do for us, and it compounds. And we need to have a reform about reproductive health information.
Exactly. And it's just not out there. It's not really out there. And one other thing that I or it's a couple other things I wanted to bring up surrounding that is the cost of it and the lack of insurance availability for it. And so how a lot of clinics are private and have their own financing, sometimes they do, or billing practices. And so would you be able to expound on how that kind of works and, you know, are people being taken advantage of that you, if you know of?
Well, it's interesting, the discussion about insurance, because insurance companies want to cover medical services that are effective and that will work. So the fact that they understand that IVF has very high failure rates per cycle, particularly in women over the age of 35. You've got a 60% failure rate in women younger than 35. And by the time you're 37 to 39, there's an 80% failure rate. By the time you're 40 to 42, there's a 90% failure rate. So the fact that the insurance companies understand that these treatments fail the vast majority of the time, from a business perspective, from the insurance perspective, it makes sense that they don't want to fund this. There are 15 states currently in the United States that are partially funding infertility treatments. But, for example, in my case, my husband and I had insurance because we lived in Massachusetts. However, even though we had insurance, the insurance didn't cover all the procedures or all the drugs, and we went into debt as well. So the insurance question is tricky. The access issue is really tricky. As you were talking about on your show yesterday, there is a myth out there that black women and women of color are fertile, when in fact women of color and women across all racial lines who are living in poverty are experiencing greater infertility because they have less access to health care. And the number one cause of infertility is untreated sexually transmitted diseases. Then you have unexplained infertility. You have blocked fallopian tubes, which IVF was initially developed to treat, and the first test tube baby was born from a woman who had blocked fallopian tubes. So IVF works sometimes, but it is not a panacea, and there are many bioethical concerns that go into third-party reproduction where donor eggs and surrogacy come into play.
Wow. So it's just, you basically need to take a course to go through this, to know all your options and all the things that are available. But getting back to the question of financing and, like, some of the clinics are they offer their own financing. So if you don't have insurance or your insurance won't cover it, then you're left to go to these clinics that are more for profit and not really for the consumer.
I think that you've struck upon a real problem within the industry. I was just reading a study that was written by a professor of marketing at MIT who was talking about the live baby or your money back marketing scheme that some of the clinics have.
Live baby
or your money back, And that started about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and it's now been picked up more frequently by different clinics that are trying different marketing schemes. The reality is that what the study concluded, what this particular MIT study concluded, was that that particular strategy, when they market it to people who are younger, who have a greater chance of conceiving through IVF, it's more profitable for the clinic because someone who might have conceived on one cycle anyway, but who might believe that it would take three cycles, would buy into their plan of, you know, three cycles for $18,000. Whereas a couple that might be older or have more serious health conditions or unexplained infertility might buy into that scheme, and the clinic knows that it's going to give a full refund back to that particular couple, but they're specifically marketing to the couples who are going to have an easier time conceiving.
So it's
a live baby or your money back happens less frequently if they're being really succinct with their targeted marketing, and they are very sophisticated targeted marketing. I do not refer to myself as a former infertility patient anymore. I refer to myself as a former health consumer of reproductive technology medical services because I do not feel like I was a patient. I felt like I was a consumer, and I was an ignorant consumer at the time.
Exactly. And it's really sad because as ignorant as a lot of us are about our own fertility, and then when we find that we have to go through the infertility process, you found out how much more you're uneducated about your body and the whole process, and then all the different things that you have to go through in infertility. It's just, you know, there are lab tests, there are different procedures, there's medication. There's just so much, and there doesn't really seem to be a one-stop place to kind of gather all the information together and all the little things. And a lot of times, in my own personal experience, the doctors and staff were well-meaning, but a lot of times they didn't really sit down and explain as in-depth as I thought they should. So often I would find myself getting things done and then leave and figure, like, what exactly did I really have done? Or why am I taking this medication or this, that, and the other, and would have to spend hours researching kind of after the fact instead of before the fact. And so it was always like kind of one hand behind my back trying to figure out what exactly was happening with me. And
I certainly feel like you're not alone, and I was in the same predicament when I was new to treatments. And, you know, what I decided to do was trust my doctors. And what I have since learned is that when it comes to this particular branch of medical services, you must be your own advocate. And it's tricky because if you don't know what questions to ask, how can you ask? And you raise a good point about there being very little support or education out there. Fortunately, but based on other people's misfortune, myself included, there are a number of books that have been written, and there are a number of blog sites out there. Silent Sorority is a wonderful book written by Pamela Sigdinos, who also went through 10 years of treatments, unexplained infertility, and she tried everything that was suggested to her, ranging from, you know, doing yoga and doing headstands after sexual intercourse to acupuncture and massage and this drug and that drug and this procedure and that procedure. And she writes what has happened in her life during those struggles and what it is like to be a childless woman by circumstance as opposed to by choice. And she talks about the way women are stigmatized for not having children. And that gets into the larger feminist discussion about women's value in society. My book, Cracked Open, Liberty, Fertility, and the Pursuit of High-Tech Babies, I wrote that book crying through every draft and every word because I kept saying to myself, how come nobody told me? How come nobody told me? How come nobody told me? So I wrote a book. It's a memoir laced with women's health information and a lot of political information about the hidden side of the infertility industry. And there's a lot of information that I think people can only learn by talking to other people who've gone through it before them. One of the problems is that people are so traumatized, particularly when the treatments fail, which is the majority of the time, that they don't want to talk about it. I've met people who, when they hear that I've written a book about infertility and the treatments I went through, they just like turn away and they say, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you. I don't even want to think about that time of my life.
Wow.
So the mental health resources are not there, but there's a growing former health consumer movement out there and also burgeoning globally that I think is really starting to force the industry to be more transparent and comprehensive about the kind of information they're sharing with patients.
Wow. And speaking of mental health, I was having a conversation earlier and discussing the fact that I'm in graduate school and had just written a paper about access to mental health. And, well, a couple of things struck me, but two major things struck me was that, number one, the stress of going through infertility was compared to the stress of going through cancer, any other seriously major medical problem. And then in a lot of the research that I found, they also said that post-IVF treatment or infertility treatment for those women who did not conceive, the depression rate for them 20 years later, there was a study out of Sweden, I think, 20 years later, those women were still suffering from some sort, from mild depression to very chronic major depression. And no treatment was either being offered or they elected not to do it. And that's scary that you have this set of individuals out there who really need help, and either by their own choice or by lack of support from their doctors are not getting it. And it just makes me wonder, what does that say about the rest of our society? You know, I don't know.
Well, I think you've struck upon something very important that a number of former patients have talked to me about, which is the fact that the human component, the emotional component, the soulful spiritual journey of wanting to become a parent is not addressed in the clinic setting. And some people say, well, it's a medical clinic. Why should they care about your soul or your spiritual path or your emotional state? They want to get your ovaries healthy and give you a baby. And my attitude is, you know, it's almost like the opposite of hospice, right? If you're trying to cultivate the beginning of new life, then you need to provide the kind of emotional, spiritual, ethical supports that couples are facing. Because in my particular case, as I write about in my book, Cracked Open, when my husband and I finally decided to stop treatments, and long story short, we spent 4 years in treatments, 4 failed IVFs, 1 miscarriage, and 2 donor egg attempts in which both donors were deemed infertile by the doctors, which was when I decided that I needed to put my journalism hat on and inquire as to why infertile women were being used as donors and why were young women who had previously been donors becoming infertile after they were donating their eggs. And that gets into a whole other segment about women's health and the fact that some of the hormones that are being used on women undergoing IVF and on women who are donating their eggs are super stimulating the ovaries to the point where young women are producing upwards of 36 to 52 eggs per cycle. And in a normal cycle, a woman drops 1 egg per month. So the amount of hormones that are being given, and there was a case in the late 90s in Israel where a doctor stimulated a patient so much that she produced 160 eggs. And the government then stepped in to regulate it. But in the United States, these clinics, unfortunately, some of them are doing whatever they believe will produce a child rather than whatever they believe is in the best interest of the consumer who's purchasing their services. So the mental health component, I just wanted to shortly say, after my long story short, 4 failed cycles, 2 attempts with egg donation where both donors were deemed infertile, I was treated for post-traumatic stress disorder with a treatment called eye movement desensitization reprocessing, EMDR, which is it's a body-oriented trauma treatment that's often used to treat soldiers coming back from combat.
Right.
So the degree of depression and PTSD that I suffered was quite severe, and I have spoken to many, many people, and they have told me that particularly when the treatments failed, they exhibited and experienced similar symptoms.
Wow. That is amazing. It's amazing. And I just, there was something else I had wanted to go into concerning, I really would like to, I wanted to know if the fertility treatments or clinics, are they, I don't know, do they go through FDA approval, AMA approval? Who are they being approved and certified for? What should we as consumers be looking for?
Well, in the United States, there is no specific oversight of what the clinics are doing. There is one federal act passed in 1992 called the Fertility Clinic Success Rate and Certification Act, where the clinics are mandated, loosely mandated, to report their success rates to the CDC. And that's all they're mandated to do. In terms of what I think a patient or a consumer needs to know is a lot of the websites for clinics talk about their pregnancy rates. They say, we get women pregnant, 80% of the time. And it's very, very easy to get excited by the word pregnancy. But miscarriages are very high with people who are having problems conceiving. So what consumers need to look for is the live birth rate. They also need to look at live birth rates per age group. And the Centers for Disease Control website has the best information. It's the most comprehensive national information. And they break it down by age. If you go to the CDC ART, ART stands for Assisted Reproductive Technology, the CDC ART website, and they'll find all kinds of information on there. It's very, very, very hard to decipher. And what the consumer needs to understand is that the clinics are putting their best foot forward. So when they go on the website, they're going to see pictures of smiling babies and happy mommies and daddies. And a group of women and I and myself decided one night over drinks in New York City after a conference on our experiences with infertility treatments, we decided that we should redesign the websites to be more accurate, which would show 20% of the photos on the website should be of smiling babies and 80% should be of women injecting experimental drugs into their bodies, men crying, women crying, NICU, pictures of babies in the neonatal intensive care unit, stillbirths. I mean, there's so much that we don't hear about from what happens when we're trying to do this, and we don't have long-term research to determine the health risks facing women undergoing undergoing treatments or the babies born from them. And that is a very, very serious concern for many women's health and human rights organizations, not just in the United States, but globally. But no one's interfering or calling for regulation or long-term funding for research on this, and it's very important that it be funded.
Wow. It's amazing a lot of things that do get covered in this country, but it just seems like overall there's a lot of lack of care for women and their reproductive lives, unless we, go into other areas, abortion or whatever. Everyone wants to be in our business. But then when it comes to us trying to have a child or, keep our bodies healthy, we don't have any strong advocates for that. And that's a very sad situation. And it's not just a U.S. problem, as you pointed out. It's a global problem.
It's a global problem that I think has been exacerbated by a lot of misinformation on the Internet. And I can speak from my own experience that when we were having trouble conceiving, I went online, and if I found something objective, for example, like a clinic that would say, if you're not responding well, we're going to turn you away, I would immediately go into psychological denial. And I talk about this in my book a lot. I just went into denial, and I said, those people are wrong. They don't know what they're talking about. I can get pregnant. And that was a kind of thinking that did enormous damage to myself and to my marriage. And it was the kind of thinking process that I refer to in my book as generating and turning me into what I call a fertility junkie. I shared with someone recently that I know a woman in California who did 18 IUIs, which is intrauterine insemination cycles, and 4 failed IVF cycles. I know a woman who did 14 IVF cycles. I know a woman who did 10 IVF cycles, and by the 8th one, for some reason, whether it was cause or effect, no one will ever know, but she was diagnosed with lymphoma. So she had cancer treatments, and then after she healed from the cancer treatments, she went right back for 2 more IVF treatments. We do not know what the hormones and drug protocols are doing to women's bodies.
There's
a lot of short-term studies out there. You'll find thousands of short-term studies with with very small study groups, but you will not find long-term comprehensive hundreds of thousands of women being studied over a period of time. And that's what we need, because the health of the women and the health of the children is at stake.
Yes, yes. And as I was saying on my show yesterday, I really think it should be mandatory for anyone, when that primary care doctor or your OBGYN gives you that referral, or you go to this commercial infertility clinic, automatically you should be enrolled in some type of counseling, support group, something, because just with the financial stress of it, then the stress of all the different processes that you have to go through, it's very emotional, it's very stressful, it's hard, and, you know, people aren't getting the support, they really aren't.
They're not. What I believe would be the best type of patient education would be six sessions, similar to what adoption agencies do when couples are considering adoption. In my situation, for example, we were mandated to go to six classes that talked about various aspects of adoption. What I would recommend for the IVF health consumer and the assisted reproductive health consumer is that they meet in a group setting with other couples and they have a session on the history of IVF. The next session would be health risks associated with IVF. The next session would be discussions about bioethics of egg donation and surrogacy. Discussion would be hearing from various medical professionals talking about what prematurity and transferring more than a single embryo, what that could mean to a family's life in terms of premature birth, neonatal intensive care unit, care for the infants. I recently wrote an article based on research from California that showed that some of the medical bills for IVF babies are 30 times higher than for naturally conceived babies, because up to 40% of all IVF babies born in the United States are twin or triplet births. And when people hear twins or triplets, they think, oh, isn't that sweet? They have twins and triplets. But the vast majority of twins and triplets are born premature. Many of them are low birth weight, and many of them have serious health problems when they're born, and there's a lot of maternal health risks at stake as well. I know more than five families who had premature babies, and they're now in debt over $1 million for the medical care. They wouldn't trade their family life for anything, but they're in debt and they are struggling.
Well, in our last, let's see here, 20 minutes or so, I would like for you to speak about some of the advocacy work that you're doing, and whether it's in infertility or any other area, because I think you're just very passionate about so many things, and I think you could offer my listeners some great information if you care to share.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I am a member of the board of Our Bodies Ourselves, which is the Global Women and Girls Health and Human Rights Organization. Our Bodies Ourselves was the first women's health organization to form in the 1970s, and they do not receive funding from pharmaceutical companies or medical companies. So they are very objective in their information, and as I mentioned earlier, coming on to their board after I completed my treatments, I was grateful and honored to be asked to join the board. I wish I had accessed them prior to going into treatment. So for those of you who are listening who are contemplating treatments or know someone who's going through treatments, it would be very important to visit the Our Bodies Ourselves website. They have a lot of information about infertility, as well as other women's health information. I'm also the founding co-producer of the Ms. Foundation for Women's Original Take Our Daughters to Work program. And that program, for those of you who still practice it, began 20 years ago, and it focused on providing opportunity for women to work in the outside world, outside the home. And mm-hmm. I think it's ironic, and a radio host recently said to me, don't you think it's ironic that, you know, you were working on the Take Our Daughters to Work program when you were most fertile and you weren't focused on having children? And I said, well, my generation, no one in my cohort in my generation was having children at age 30. We were going to college. We were excited about work opportunities and economic opportunity and mm-hmm. understanding how we fit into the public policy world, the political world, the economic world. Women deserve a voice there. But I think what was left out of the feminist women's movement discussion was how to create a balance. And I think the pendulum had swung out of the kitchen and the house into the world. And I think if we can tackle the biology of women's reproductive lifespan and understand that fertility does decline, despite all the screaming memes on the internet and in the media saying that fertility doesn't decline with age, we could begin to create the kind of work-family policies in this country that really honor families. They honor women to have their children at the most biologically safe time. They don't, employers don't penalize women for having children and for opting out of the workplace. There's got to be a way to balance this. And, business people will just look at me and laugh and say, oh, why would someone want to hire a woman who's going to have pregnancies, 2 years after I hire her? And it's like, you know what? That's the way of the world. You should create workplace policies that support women to have their children at their healthiest, not entice women to come work for you by saying, we'll give you 3 IVF cycles as part of your compensation package. Because the businesses that are relying on reproductive technology to get the best out of a legal candidate or a medical candidate who happens to be female doesn't understand the risks involved, the emotional risks, the women's health risks, and the bioethical concerns culturally, as well as the stresses emotionally that are going on with the individual and the couple.
So are there any new projects that you're working on right now that you would care to share with my listeners?
Well, right now I am doing a lot of organizing nationally and globally to create a peer education movement around the reproductive technologies to talk not just about the health issues but also about the ethical issues. For example, in the course of my book tour, I met with some women who are now retired egg donors who have suffered extreme health problems as a result of donating their eggs. Other egg donors that I've met with who donated their eggs when they were 20 and they're now 30 or 35, they're now wondering if they have a child in the world that they'll never meet. And many of them consider themselves mothers who've never met their children. I think this is very new territory for us, and that we as a society and a civilization are just kind of we're not going deep enough, and shows like yours are important because it provides background data and background information that most people don't have access to unless they're doing the research, unless they've had the experience and they know what to ask. For example, I think one thing that I have accomplished with my book to really kind of reverse the framework to some degree in some circles, I had a op-ed in the New York Times that I co-authored last year that addresses the fact that the marketing of the reproductive technologies has been focused on successes since the first test tube baby was born in 1978. And from the very beginning, there's been this perception that the doctors reached into a hat and pulled out the white rabbit. But prior to pulling out the white rabbit, there had been 80 years of research and genetic manipulation of the female egg in animals and then later on humans. There were many unethical experimentations that were done on humans, not just around the reproductive technology, but, you know, with other forms of treatment. And we don't have a lot of funding for fertility research in the United States because it requires the use of human eggs. And stem cell research is very controversial. And stem cell research requires the use of human eggs. There is a black market globally for human eggs. There are many fertility clinics that are housed in the same building as stem cell research clinics. There are over 600,000 frozen eggs in the United States alone. I'm sorry, not frozen eggs, frozen embryos. And worldwide, we have many, many frozen embryos in storage. So what will be done at some point, you know, in 20 or 30 years, will there be a billion frozen embryos on ice around the world? What will become of those frozen embryos? I am a pro-choice feminist, and I have been in dialogue with individuals who tell me that if I am questioning the use of technology to help people have families, then I am anti-science. And what I say to them is, I am not anti-science. I am pro-science, and I am pro-human rights. I am pro-protection of health consumers to make sure that what they're doing is safe for them and their families. And I do not believe that this industry has done the kind of long-term research that that should be done before they wave a green flag saying, come on in and try our latest cocktail here. And the egg freezing technology was recently, the label of experimentation was lifted off of it in 2012 by the American Society of Assisted Reproduction. And that is a lobby group for the clinics. And I don't know why they removed the experimental label, because there's only been about 1,000 babies born from the technology, all to women younger than age 30 who were going through cancer treatments, and they wanted to have an opportunity to have children later. So the eggs were frozen. And what we don't know is how freezing eggs in liquid nitrogen is going to affect the children down the line. We have absolutely no data on babies born from that technology. And to me, that's a problem. Some of the other advocacy work that I'm doing, some of the topics include technologies that people are beginning to use for eye color selection, hair color selection, skin color selection.
I've heard about
gender
that.
Gender selection.
Ridiculous. Wow.
Well, it's in the old days, if the state mandated a eugenics policy, people would protest against it. And the gender selection and abortion rates of female fetuses in China has been a human rights concern for years. And the United States has cried out about it, saying, that's terrible what you're doing in China. Stop, stop, stop. But that's exactly what's starting to happen with the clinics in this country. It's called high-tech eugenics. It's now driven by consumers and the notion of choice rather than by the state. So it's hands-off because the consumer's always right, or the consumer's entitled, or if you have the money, you can do whatever you want to do. And I find it troubling. I don't think we've had enough reflective conversation on this. We haven't. We haven't had the kind of town meetings around these type of topics. And though it's a small percentage of children who are born from these technologies today, in the future, we don't know what it holds. But I think that we need to determine as a society, you know, do we want to be creating and allowing technologies that can allow people to only have blonde-haired, blue-eyed babies or dark-haired babies, or do we want nature to be selecting? And this is not a religious question. This is an ethical question. This is a question about democracy and opportunity and human rights. And there's also child rights at stake. There are children who are born through anonymous embryos via surrogacy. So those children will never know who their parents are. And if the adoptive parents choose to tell that child where they came from, there will be no way to trace the lineage or the genetic connections to those children. And in some cases, parents never disclose to the children at all. And there's all kinds of legal discussions and ethical legal discussions about what are the rights of the child in this situation. And do we need public policy that says that, you know, the donor eggs or donor sperm, that those that donate those gametes, that they at eight, when the child turns 18, they have a right to contact that person if they want to, just the way with open adoption that happens.
Right.
So there's all, I mean, there's a gamut, there's a full range of advocacy issues that I'm working on. It's endless, and it's interactive. It just goes deeper and deeper. One thing leads to another thing. I just read an article recently about a very wealthy Japanese businessman who hired 9 surrogates, and the surrogates have birthed the children. None of the children have birth certificates, and the police in Japan are investigating whether or not this man is producing children specifically for the black market adoption market.
Wow.
Yeah. And in India, with the commercial surrogacy, a lot of the commercial surrogate clinics are specifically recruiting poor women in the slums, many of them who are illiterate. And they're saying, you know, you can make $6,000 by becoming pregnant for this family in Britain or Germany or the United States. Do you want to do it? And they say, yes, of course. And they don't necessarily know what they're getting into. They don't have the option of a vaginal birth. They're forced to have C-sections. So, I mean, there's all kinds of things going on behind the scenes that we need to talk much more about.
Very much so. And I'm happy that you were able to come on my show and to educate myself and the listening public out there, because there's so many things going on that we're just not aware of, that the information is just not getting out there. As much as we have the internet and all of that, is unless you're looking for it, you don't really know what's happening.
You're absolutely
and I
right.
think that's sad. I think that's really, really sad. And, I don't – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, as I said earlier, health consumers need to be very wary of this industry. And and also the media, like for every story, for every one story saying there's some trouble over here with this particular clinic or this particular drug might be causing cancer down the line, et cetera, there's, for every one of those cautionary watchdog stories, there's 200 stories saying the family in Kent, England is so happy because after 10 years of unsuccess with IVF, they finally had their baby. So most of the stories generated in the media are marketed and narrated by the industry and turned into news. And it's that's why it's so important for people to read books like mine or Silent Sorority. There's another book called The Pursuit of Motherhood by Jessica Hepburn out of Britain. Jessica Hepburn has unexplained infertility. She wrote a book. She was tossed from clinic to clinic to clinic doing all kinds of procedures, and the last procedure she did was a total body blood transfusion. They said, oh, you have something, you need a total body blood transfusion. And I thought to myself, what the heck is going on here? There's something really, really wrong there, both with the mental health, lack of mental health supports for her, but also the clinics just trying anything, a total body blood transfusion.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
That's the only word I can really, I'm just like in shock right now. I'm like, wow.
It's crazy. It's exploitative. It, you know, the doctors may be well-meaning and they'll be like, well, it worked for, you know, we've only done it 50 times, and if you want to try it, you can do a trial with us. And someone will say, well, okay. I know a woman who went through, she had 3 failed IUIs, 3 failed IVFs, and 3 failed surrogacy attempts, because surrogacy doesn't work all the time on the first try by any means. And when she was going through her IVFs, her doctor gave her 6 times the dosage of Lupron that's recommended.
Oh, wow.
And
Wow.
And she said, do it, do it, do it. The women who are going through
right.
these procedures are under so much emotional stress that they're saying, do
mm-hmm.
whatever it takes, even if it harms them. And
right.
I would put myself in that category as well.
Yeah.
I've learned the hard way.
As I was having a conversation about that yesterday, it's like, when do you know to stop? Who do we have there to keep us from, I don't want to say harming ourselves, but putting ourselves through that trauma over and over again? Because going through it myself as well, I was very lucky with my doctor, who was just like, okay, we've tried this, we've tried that, and I just need you to understand that, your body is not
yeah.
working, basically. And,
yeah.
You've had other traumas to your body, and unfortunately, this is your reality. And to be honest, I'm maybe still in denial because it's all still very fresh, and I want to say, I'm just not fitting the protocol for that clinic because I'm older, I have a history of cancer, and so maybe I need to try another clinic. And it's like, okay, am I really accepting my reality, or
mm-hmm.
am I selling myself a dream? So
mm-hmm.
I don't know when to answer that. No one can really answer that, I guess, but myself. But I think, like I said before, I think I want at least one attempt at IVF. And if that doesn't work, then I know I need to walk away and just accept whatever is going to happen and try to maybe move on to adoption or whatever other options I may have, because I really don't know. Besides having a donor, I know that I don't want to do an egg donor because I feel like I'm not that excited about going through the physical processes of being pregnant. So I might as well adopt if I have
mm-hmm.
the only option of being an egg donor. And, that decision, every decision is different for every person, because we're all different and we all have our different experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well,
I guess...
I think you raise really important questions as well, because there are many people who I've spoken to since my book was published
mm-hmm.
that have talked to me about their desire to be mothers
mm-hmm.
versus their desire to be pregnant and birth a child.
Right.
And there are many, many, many ways we can be mothers in this world. If the focus is on a genetically linked child, then I think the IVF technologies are marketed that way to say,
right.
For example, my doctor said, well, your chances look pretty low. You could live a life without children. You could try this, or you could adopt. And the fact that you could try this could potentially give you a genetically linked child is part of the marketing involved
yes.
with those treatments, because prior to the rise of those treatments, which I will say again, fail the vast majority of the time, 80% mm-hmm. globally, 71% in the United States, IVF failure rates per cycle, before the rise of those treatments, when someone was unable to become pregnant, there was nothing you could do
right.
except accept it. You would accept
right, right.
it, and you would heal, and people
mm-hmm.
were respected. Today,
mm-hmm.
if you are having trouble conceiving and you don't go into debt or divorce your spouse as a result of trying a million cycles or some type of drug protocol that doesn't have evidence-based medicine behind it, then
mm-hmm.
you're being viewed as someone who didn't try hard enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a huge burden for people facing
right.
infertility to deal with, because it is so painful. The news is so painful when it's delivered, and then to have it be this kind of cultural peer pressure, pronatal, if you don't have a baby, if you don't try a million cycles, if you give up, you didn't want it bad enough.
Right.
If you don't put yourself through 20 years of IVF cycles, you didn't want to be a mother bad enough. Whereas, if we had a healthier conversation about it and there was healthier mental health supports about it, a woman and a man or a partners, whoever they were, would be mm-hmm. able to say, well, there's other ways that I can be a mother or a father. And it gets very, very tricky, for example, with commercial surrogacy. One of the largest consumers of commercial surrogacy are gay men. And in the old days, before commercial surrogacy and before gay marriage was legalized, gay men couldn't have families. Now they can have families. But many of them are not opting for adoption. Many of them are opting for this commercial surrogacy where there's a price tag on women's reproductive capacity and there's a price tag on the child. And that gets into trouble. When you have a relative choosing to birth a child for you out of altruistic reasons, there's a different message and a different contract between the parents and the surrogate. But it's a very, very tricky debate right now, and I think feminists are on opposite sides of this themselves, as well as bioethicists who talk about putting a price tag on life and putting a price tag on the womb. It gets into very, very uncomfortable situations, and we haven't had the kind of public discourse about it that I think we need to. So I'm very, very grateful that you're having a show like this where you're talking about it.
Yeah. And one other point that I wanted to bring up that we were talking about earlier in this discussion that I was the ladies yesterday from the infertility support group is this thing of shaming. I don't know as far as, like, the general public, but I know, especially kind of in the African-American society, that back in the day, you might have that aunt who didn't have any children, and you kind of usually looked at her as this old mean spinster, and it was never really thought of maybe she can't have kids, and nobody talked about it, and nobody said anything. And I mean, like you said, there were no options out there, so they just did have to accept it, and probably back then, they probably didn't even think about going to the doctor to say, hey, how come I haven't gotten pregnant or whatever, but there's still a lot of shaming going on, you know, with those of us who can't conceive or, you know, who choose not to conceive. We are very, in this society, we're very intrusive. We want to know what your sexuality is. We want to know what your race is. We want to know why you're 35 and you don't have kids or not married. And really, why is that any of our business unless that person chooses to disclose it? I'm not going to lie. I used to do the same thing until with race, I got kind of really tired of people asking me, what are you? What am I? I'm a person. And so, you know, it caused me to stop kind of asking that question as well. And then when it came to the whole issue of having children, it's like, I used to ask those questions. Well, why do you have kids? It's none of my business. Now that I'm going through it, it's touchy. And so now I don't think I want to be asking people if they don't offer up why they don't have kids, why they're not married. It's really none of my business.
Well, I think that's a really good point. For example, you now know, as do I, that when you are unable to have children and you want to have them, it is extremely painful, and I think if there was a deeper consciousness among the general public to approach people and ask about their life rather than directly say, oh, do you have kids? Or if you see a photograph on the desk, say, are those your kids? You say, oh, who are those? Who are those children? And then they say, those are my children, or those are my niece and nephew, or those are my neighbor's kids. You're absolutely right. There's an assumption and a judgment, and we do not know how to support those who are going through the pain of infertility. Another reason that I wrote my book was so that mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers and friends and colleagues of people who are going through treatments can understand that those individuals are raw nerves and that those people going through treatments are in so much pain and they're so stressed and they probably mm-hmm. have a lot of anxiety when they go home from work. If they've had failed psych miscarriages, they will cry their eyes out for hours. I thought I would never stop crying.
Right, yes.
I thought I would never stop crying.
Yep.
And thank God I have. It took me a long time to stop crying, but I finally have.
Right.
But
there was actually a great article about that grief and infertility out the other, just yesterday, I just read it, about how we're never giving the process to really grieve, like going through that 2-week cycle, you know, in between having like an IVF and or IUI, and you're waiting that 2 weeks. You never really, when it fails, you don't get a chance to kind of, okay, that's a child that's never going to be or never happened, mm-hmm. and you jump into the next mm-hmm. cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And so you make some excellent points. You make some excellent points. And
if people want to read more articles about grief and other mental health aspects, on my website, www.miriamzoll.net, they can go to the news section, and there's a lot of articles about the mental health and emotional stresses that are
right.
not adequately addressed by the clinics in particular.
Right.
So that, I mean, that's, there are a lot of resources on my website. I also think the Silent Sorority blog is an excellent blog and website for people to check out. My Cracked Open Liberty, Fertility, and the Pursuit of High-Tech Babies Facebook page also has a lot of articles and resources on it that people can check out to find out more information.
Right. Well, I want to thank you. You have been awesome today. I apologize about earlier. Thank you for your time, giving me this extra time to spend with you and having this great educational, heartwarming, soul-bearing conversation with me today about our struggles in infertility. And thank you for being an advocate and writing that book and speaking out for us and for the future us women who are out there who will need our support. And just for my listeners in general, even if they're not going through infertility, by you listening to this show and sharing this information with someone you know, you may be able to help a woman out there save herself from having to go through infertility or give her help her have better knowledge and be better prepared for going
mm-hmm.
through infertility treatment. And so thank you so much. I mean, this is helping me through my healing process. And I can't thank you enough.
Well, thank you so much for thinking of me. And please let me know if there's anything I can do off the air to provide more support for you and other listeners who might call in. I'm happy to talk with folks.
Thank you so much. And you have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yes, bye-bye. You've been listening to Get Deep and Keep It Real with Tiffany Camilla. Thank you so much for joining my show today. I hope you enjoyed it. It got really deep and emotional, but we have to go there sometimes to get the resources and the information that we really need. And if you have any questions or need any more information about what we spoke on today, please hit me up on Facebook and Twitter, and I'll make sure I get back with you. Or alternately, you can reach me on my at my email, Get Deep and Keep It Real, all one word, gmail.com. Once again, thank you for joining me, Tiffany Camilla, Get Deep and Keep It Real. Make sure you check me out tomorrow. Yes, Get Deep and Real, 3 days in a row. What's up? Yes, kicking the knowledge out there for you. All right, have a great day. Peace, love, and happiness.